The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Hard to believe we're already at Friday once again. These weeks just go by so fast, and we have a lot to get to today. Pretty difficult for me, actually, to really focus today's program. Just so many stories that had kind of been piling up. And, of course, you come to the last show of the week, and you want to try to just tie everything together as best you can. But I do have a few things, as I say, that have stacked up over the last few days. We have some emails that have come in. If we have time at the end of the show, we'll wrap up with that, as we've tended to do on the Friday program. Also, there's an interesting segment, I hope, on the case for colonialism, something that we discussed in our reading group last evening, and an excellent piece by someone. I forget where it came from, but we'll delve into that in the second segment. And if we have time, there's a chunk from a recent lecture that I gave at the college on eternal judgment that we can get into either today, or if that gets pushed back, hopefully we can delve into that on Monday. Well, there's quite a few people in the United States, particularly coming from the more conservative wing, that are up in arms over the illegal immigrant who shot Kate Steinle in San Francisco a few years back. This immigrant who had been deported, I think, five times, and then he was wanted for a sixth deportation. Well, he was on trial for murder and involuntary manslaughter, and he was acquitted of those charges. And I guess the only charge that stuck was with carrying a firearm. And President Trump was pretty quick. I mean, if you recall, during the campaign last year, he used this particular case as support for his call to build a wall. And he was quick to tweet yesterday a disgraceful verdict in the Kate Steinle case. No wonder the people of our country are so angry with illegal immigration. And of course, anticipating this kind of reaction, you had the defense attorneys for this illegal immigrant who came out right after the acquittal and said, hey, you know, you guys in Washington, you're in the case of President Trump, you're under investigation. You want a right to a fair trial, and that's what we've had here. The defense attorney came out and said yesterday, from day one, this case was used as means to foment hate, to foment division, to foment a program of mass deportation. So he comes from the other side of the political spectrum, quite obviously. And isn't it amazing, whether it's a big story or a little story or anything in between, there's such division, two divided camps. No matter the subject, no matter the topic, no matter the controversy, you can't get America to come together for anything. And then the sides, too, their position that they take is so strong and so far removed from the other side. Just a sharp, sharp division. There was a piece on Fox this morning saying that the Justice Department is considering bringing federal charges against this illegal immigrant now that he's been let off from the California courts. And so we'll see where this goes and if it leads to any kind of unity in the United States. Of course, it won't. Just more and more division. And it's what we're seeing now, too, between the United States and Britain, even over a seemingly insignificant story. Yet another tweet by President Trump, who came out and I guess he retweeted the other day something about the UK coming from a far-right Twitter page, some far-right organization here in the UK. And so he retweeted it. And then there were quite a few leaders here in the UK that were quick to condemn what the president did or what he retweeted. This is what Theresa May said, I think, yesterday or the day before. Clip number two.
The fact that we work together does not mean that we're afraid to say when we think the United States have got it wrong, and to be very clear with them, and I'm very clear, that retweeting from Britain First was the wrong thing to do.
Britain First is the far-right group. And now the Telegraph this morning talked about how that there was this trip that Donald Trump had planned to visit the UK in, I think, January. Let me just pick it up here. It says, Mr. Trump, the U.S. president, had been penciled in for a working visit in the first month of 2018 to formally open America's new London embassy. It says the trip's scaled-down version of a state visit with no meeting with the Queen was intended to allow Trump to come to the U.K. while avoiding the mass protests a full state visit would likely trigger. However, the Telegraph can reveal that the trip has been pushed into the long grass, with no new date in the diary picked. And so if this is the reason, this spat between the two leaders, that too is pretty amazing. This is all that it takes. And you remember, I mean, he came into office looking to strengthen that special relationship. Now, we know there's a number of prophecies that inform us of what is to happen in the lead up to the return of Jesus Christ. And just before the Great Tribulation period, that these two nations, these brother nations, the United States, Great Britain, and Little Judah, or Israel in the Middle East, that this relationship between these three brothers, these cousins, it's to unravel. And we saw a lot of that during the Obama administration. And it looked as though President Trump wanted to repair the damage and wanted to back Britain, even as it left the European Union, and wanted to establish good trade relations with Britain. But here is all that it takes. And you talk about a massive distraction. Listen to what the British MPs were debating in Parliament the other day. This is clip one.
Mr. Speaker, about a month ago, the most popular man in the world was a last-day employee of Twitter who unplugged the account of the President of the United States. Was he not right? And if Twitter is genuine in its commitment to fight hate crime online, it should have no hesitance in taking down the Twitter account of the first citizen of the US as it would any other citizen of the world who peddles such hate crime.
I am sure that the chief executive of Twitter will have heard the interesting suggestion from my honourable friend, and we will leave it to them to decide what action to take.
As if, as Richard Palmer was saying earlier today, as if there's nothing better to worry about in the world today than to stand up in the House of Commons and to call upon Twitter to delete the account of the President of the United States. He's got like something like 43 million followers on Twitter. But he should be banned for hate crime. He'll, again, when I get to this story about colonialism, there's just some things that, I mean, these are conservative MPs. There's just some things that can't be said or done or retweeted or commented on without these kinds of calls for banning speech. This is becoming more and more common. And then, as I say, when you look at the world and the problems that we're facing, nation against nation, the problems that we have within our nations, we've been pushing back quite a few stories all through this week on the coalition in Germany, or lack thereof. There was a story in Politico the other day that that suggested that Merkel might not be able to put together a government until after Easter. I mean, we talked about it possibly happening after Christmas. Now it's getting pushed back. This caretaker government that's there right now, really an ineffective coalition or government, it's not going to be able to do anything. Several months, as this carries on. Could this be the end of Angela Merkel? Is this her last stand? The clock started ticking, it says, after her failure to win decisively in September. This is actually from, I failed to write it down. This is not from a Politico. It's some other piece. But in any event, it says the chatter among fellow Christian Democrats is that Ms. Merkel has still not recovered from the setback. She is said to lack energy. She offers no indication of a grand design for the next 4 years. She is increasingly reliant on a small band of familiar advisors. She had fully intended to make way for someone else before this year's election, visitors to the chancellery are told. So this is not the sign of a strong leader ready to carry Germany into the future. There's another story here. I won't get into it, I guess, in detail. But it talks about the chances of her, you know, seeing it through to the end of this four-year term. They're very slim. I mean, who has been talking about this? Here you have all of these right-wing parties that are just salivating at the thought of gaining more power. And you have Merkel's party and then the sister party in Bavaria. I mean, they're panicking. They're panicking. I thought this article from Project Syndicate, I was given this morning, just the language that it uses. Again, it talks about the dominance of Germany on the continent. Its economic dominance. I mean, it's there's no contest. It rules the continent. It rules Europe. But then this article says, I forget who this is by, but it says, that's right, while almost every other European country, including Germany, is struggling to form a government or has settled for an unstable ruling coalition, the provincial strongmen, look at that, the provincial strongmen in Poland, Slovakia, and Hungary can guarantee stability. So here there's a few of these nations in the East that are led by strongmen. It says, whatever one thinks of Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his brand of illiberal democracy, there is no denying that he has created a secure environment for German business interests. The same cannot be said for Russia. Well, it goes on and talks about a number of other things, too. But notice the use there of strong men. You think about the latest Trumpet cover. King Me is the banner headline. The rise of strong men heralds a dangerous new era. I mean, that's just a few examples. And we discuss all of them in this latest issue of the Trumpet. Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, Austria, of course, you can add. But then beyond Europe, you've got Putin in Russia, President Xi in China, the North Korean authoritarian, and on it goes. They're popping up all over the place. They're in the Middle East as well. Strong men. That's the exact word that Project Syndicate uses in its article today about basically this is what Germany needs. This is what Germany needs to bring stability. Just like some of these other nations to the east, Poland, Slovakia, Hungary. Make sure if you haven't looked at it already, some of you may not have gotten it in the mail just yet, but it's posted online, this latest Trumpet magazine, King Me. I believe it's the January issue already of the Trumpet, posted for your reading pleasure at thetrumpet.com. Well, a few other items that, as I say, have stacked up through the week. We talked earlier in the week about North Korea, this article from the Weekly Standard saying basically it's over, you know, trying to deter them from getting the mass destruction weapon and the delivery system. They've got both. They've got both. They're a nuclear power. North Korea is a nuclear power, Weekly Standard says. It also has a highly sophisticated missile program. The two will soon be linked, if they're not already, and Pyongyang will shortly have the ability to launch nuclear attacks on the United States mainland. It says later, the goal of preventing North Korea from going nuclear is farcical at this point. And then to see, you know, speaking of farcical or laughable maybe, to see the leftist media focusing in on Donald Trump as being the problem. He's been in there for 10 months. Here, this program, it's been constructed over the last two or three decades under the watch of President Clinton, under the watch of President Bush, George W. Bush, and then President Obama. And now Trump is evidently the problem. And then there's all these voices in the left wing that are talking about his mental instability. Not the tyrant in North Korea, the president of the United States. He's the madman. He's the one supposedly suffering from dementia. He's the one that has Alzheimer's. He's the one that we've got to get out of office. Here again, look at what the United States and Britain are preoccupied with. Even as the world is burning. The goal of preventing North Korea from going nuclear is farcical. Joel Hilliker's trumpet brief from last night. Make sure that you read that. If you didn't get the email, you can sign up for the daily trumpet brief at thetrumpet.com, and then we post those briefs, most of them, a little bit later on our blog pages. But he talks about that new booklet I mentioned it the other day. Nuclear Armageddon is at the door. What will it take for people to wake up to the dangers? They're all around. They're all around. George Friedman at Geopolitical Futures, he talked about how Iran is reshaping the Middle East. Where have you heard this before? Where have you heard this? It's prophesied. The King of the South, it's busy reshaping the region. He gives some history here, Friedman does, about the U.S. involvement in pushing back the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, and how that the U.S. had very little choice but to support Iran and the Iraqi forces in pushing back. But now that ISIS has been crushed, now that the U.S. wants out, look at the region. Look at Iran's position in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Yemen. It says in this Friedman piece, the Middle East has a new and radically different shape. For the moment, Iran has been freed to assert itself. See, this is exactly what we said would happen. We said it even at the start of the war against terrorism. We were saying it in 2001, 2002, and in 2003 when the U.S. was going into Iraq. Remember, we said, I don't have the quote here in front of me, but to paraphrase, we said, look, it may not seem like it right now, given the strength of U.S. power in the region. But here's what your Bible says. When the dust settles on this so-called war against terror, you can expect Iran to come out on top. And that's what's happened. That's amazing. That's amazing. The New York Times had a story a few days ago. Long divided, Iran unites against Trump and the Saudis in a nationalist fervor. It talks about the nationalist fervor rising in Iran. And who's to blame for this? Well, of course, it's Donald Trump. Nothing happened before January 21st of this year. Iran's quest for the nuclear bomb, Iran's repeated vows to destroy the great Satan, to wipe Israel off the map, none of that matters. I mean, you read this New York Times piece, and it's as if they were just the sweetest, most innocent nation on earth. And then Donald Trump came along and cast a doubt on the Iran nuke deal. And so that made all the Iranians mad, don't you know? And so now they're banding together in this nationalist fervor. Well, the one thing the New York Times gets right is that there is a nationalist fervor against Saudi Arabia. I mean, there's going to be two camps. I mean, the nationalist fervor is there against the U.S. as well, for sure. But to pin all the blame on President Trump, that's what's ridiculous. But the two camps, that's Psalm 83. We're seeing that take shape. And even the Times, though it brings up so many points that shouldn't be brought up. But even the Times is acknowledging, look, this is a rising power. And like Friedman says, it's reshaping the Middle East. There's a story in The Observer. Again, you look at what's happening in these regions, these ascendant powers in the Middle East, in the East, the kings of the East, as the Bible says. Then you have the king of the North, the European power. And then you see stories like this. And considering prophecies like Daniel 11 and verse 40, where the U.S. and Britain, they're not even mentioned. Here's this great, spectacular clash between the kings of the North and South and the U.S. and Britain. They're not even mentioned. Well, here's why. The Observer says British and American militaries face budgetary crises and cuts. That's what's happening in Britain and the United States. I mentioned that story the other day about how Britain's just struggling to keep it up to 70,000 or so. That's the strength or the numbers in the military. They set the goal of 82,000. Well, it's already down to 79,000, and they're fearing it's going to drop to 70,000. 70,000 military personnel. Just a tiny little army in Great Britain. A not-so-great army in Great Britain. It says here, the Royal Navy, which once ruled the seas, will acquire two giant aircraft carriers, but it will not have sufficient aircraft to man these behemoths. How about that? Two aircraft carriers, but no aircraft. No aircraft. What do you do with two aircraft carriers when you don't have the aircraft? It says, and the RAF, which won the Battle of Britain, is a sliver of its former self. Worse yet, the special relationship between America and Britain, in part based on military-to-military and intelligence linkages established during World War II, is at risk. I mean, the special relationship. It doesn't take anything more than a Twitter war to begin to sever that alliance. You have members of Parliament calling for the President of the United States with 43 million followers to be banned from Twitter. Well, this is taking up important debate time. He should be banned. He's guilty of hate speech. It says a firestorm has erupted in Britain over these proposed cuts. Cuts to the military. Last weekend, a very senior member of the House of Commons called me in despair over what could happen to the British military. A large number of former conservative defense ministers and retired generals have registered their strongest protests. But no matter how this debate is resolved in Whitehall, the pressures to slash defense have already crossed the Atlantic. And so here comes the problem, as it is in the United States. Though the differences are important, the outcome for both militaries could be the same. Hollow forces, unready, and ill-prepared to carry out their missions. How about this? Here's a piece at The Observer about the militaries of the United States and Britain facing a series of crises. The symptoms are unmistakable, it says. In the U.S. Navy, operational overextension and underfunding have produced a rash of collisions and accidents. I think there was one just the other day again. They're happening every month or two now. Further on, it says, unlike Britain, where the danger stems from immediate defense spending cuts, two more insidious factors threaten the U.S. military. The first is uncontrollable internal real annual cost growth of about 5 to 7% for every budget item from people to precision weapons to pencils. And then second, it says, the budgetary bureaucratic political oversight process has become Frankensteinian. So a big bureaucratic bloated mess. And you have these two militaries, these two once great powers, the United States and Great Britain, struggling just to get enough funding to keep up with modest increases, if that, or in the case of the UK military, to keep it from plummeting to below 70,000. Well, a few other items here on some social issues following on the engagement between Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. There was a piece at The Spectator a day or two ago. Again, the fellow was all for marriage, as he says at the start of his piece. But I'm just not sure this one, this marriage, is entirely good news for the monarchy. Well, it isn't. I mean, go back. I forget which day it was, but we had a fair bit to say on the day following the engagement. I think it might have been Tuesday's program. But that, of course, as well as all of our podcasts, all of our live radio broadcasts, we convert them to podcasts later and post them all at thetrumpet.com. The same is true, of course, with the Trumpet Hour and a number of other programs that we produce at KPCG, our local radio station in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream being available at kpcg.fm or at thetrumpet.com. Yesterday, I was given this story as well. We'll just conclude the segment with this. It's I don't want to quote so much from it, but it's at Wired magazine. The Great Tech Panic, it says, the inevitability of porn. Just a shocking statistic it has here in the introduction. It says that one porn site, I guess it's called Pornhub, it's the largest pornography site on the internet. And what was it? Last year, over the course of 1 year, there were 92 billion videos watched on that one website. 92 billion. We've got something like, what, 7 billion people on Earth? 92 billion people. It amounts to something like 13 or 14 videos for every human being. That's the averages. And this is just one website that we're talking about. And the author of this piece, I mean, he kind of sets it up, tongue in cheek. Hey, this is super popular, and not that I'm against that. You know, it's pornography after all. We've got to make it available. But I do have two young sons. And so I've sought the counsel of pop psychologist so-and-so to give me some indication or some advice on how to deal with this. And basically, the author, together with the counsel coming from this psychologist or this counselor, the author reaches the conclusion that, well, young people are going to see it at some point. So deal with it. So just get used to it. It's part of our culture. Remember what we talked about yesterday? That op-ed piece at the New York Times? Look, the solution to all of this evil and this filth that we're seeing, headline after headline after headline, the solution is the culture. Whatever that means specifically. But look at our culture. Evil through and through. People want to talk about toxic masculinity. How about toxic pornography? Is this toxic? 92 billion? Seriously? This is toxic. It's destroying America. And that author's little boys, presuming they grow up on this sort of content, it only heightens their chances of ending up like so many of these other big names that we've been reading about in the news, day in and day out. Look at the filth that our young people, they are bombarded with it. And even the most vigilant parent, there are probably some things that are going to fall through the cracks. Just because of how it's hurled at us from every direction on TV or on the internet or on billboards, over the radio. It is ubiquitous, there's no doubting that. But just the casual tone of this article, like, well, just get used to it, it's everywhere. So we have to accept it, right? But then the furor, when you see people carrying out these pornographic fantasies, in their office space or at work or in Congress or in a Hollywood studio. Like I was saying yesterday, I mean, the filth is put on the silver screen every single day. The very acts that we're reading about and that we're supposedly appalled about now, it's fine, though. It's fine if you're just acting it out and then broadcasting it for all the world to see. And all the world is seeing it. 92 billion videos. 92 billion videos watched just last year. You want to talk about root causes? Here's where you go. Here's where you go. Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. I mean, what's on the inside, what's in your heart is eventually going to show itself in its actions. Sure enough, that's why we've got to target sin at the source. Satan the devil is the prince of the power of the air, it says in Ephesians 2. And so we've got to disconnect from his influence and plug in to God and to the things of God and to the standards of God and to the truth of God. As I said yesterday, God's word is truth. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
So in our reading club here at Edstone, we're reading through William Manchester's Visions of Glory. I think we're up through, just looking at the calendar of the date, we're up through about 1899 or 1900. When Churchill was captured in South Africa, or what became South Africa, there during the Boer War, and was taken captive and then made his escape, his miraculous escape, really. And maybe I'll get into that at some other time. But as we were discussing last night, you read a lot about his early days. I think he was born in 1874, so the 1890s. Churchill was a teenager and a young man in his early 20s, and he was a lover of all things empire. He wanted to see the British Empire expand its reach, its influence. And Manchester brings out how that if you look at Great Britain in the late 1800s, I mean, they had regiments in action practically on every continent, on five continents. They were fighting for the Union Jack. They were fighting for the British Empire. And like Manchester brings out, they were almost always victorious. And they had just a small number of casualties. He gives one statistic in his book, how that in the last 12 years of the 19th century, the British Empire expanded its control over 2.6 million square miles of territory. And so it was just devouring regions or territories on Earth. He quotes from one of Winston Churchill's speeches as a young man in his 20s. I guess he would have been about 23 at this point. This is his first political speech, 1897. Winston Churchill said, there are not wanting those who say that in this jubilee year of our empire has reached the height of its glory and power, and that we now should begin to decline as Babylon, Carthage, and Rome declined. Churchill said, do not believe these croakers. Do not believe them, but give the lie to their dismal croaking by showing by our actions that the vigor and vitality of our race is unimpaired, and that our determination is to uphold the empire that we have inherited from our fathers as Englishmen. I mean, we've inherited this. This is a glorious history. We should extend what our forefathers gave to us. He said further on in the speech, then shall we continue to pursue that course marked out for us by an all-wise hand and carry out our mission of bearing peace, civilization, and good government to the uttermost ends of the earth. That's what they were doing. That's where Manchester brings out how that the way that young Englishmen saw it back in the day, that by extending the empire, they were rescuing people from pagans, from savagery. They were exposing people over all the earth to a better way of life, to a better form of government, to more freedoms. That's certainly what Winston Churchill believed. He was a man of empire. He said to keep the empire, you have to have the imperial spark. You have to have that empire, that imperial spark. Well, today, empire, colonialism, these have a bad name today. These are looked upon with scorn today. There was a professor by the name of Bruce Gilley. He works at, Portland State University. And I forget how far back this went. I think it was fairly recent. He wrote this paper for this journal, this academic journal, Third World Quarterly. So here comes this political scientist. He writes this paper, and the title of it is The Case for Colonialism. The Case for Colonialism. And he said, for the last 100 years, Western colonialism has had a bad name. It is high time, he said, to question this orthodoxy. It's high time to question it. Okay, this is an academic journal. Let's question the orthodoxy. This is what you do, right? In a free society. This is what you do in the university. You research it out. You present your facts coming from your study. Well, this is what Nigel Bigger had to say at the Times. He said, predictably, this is, again, it's following Bruce Gilley's paper at Third World Quarterly. He said, predictably, a perfect storm of protest erupted. As Gilley tells it, 15 of the 34 members of Third World Quarterly, the editorial board, resigned. Two petitions demanding a retraction gathered over 16,000 signatures. Fellow academics accused him of promoting white supremacy. And the editor eventually withdrew the essay under death threats from Indian nationalists. So here is a message that is just, it's not tolerable. You cannot print it. You cannot get into it in an academic journal. You cannot teach this. They tried to, like they've done on many campuses with speakers. They tried to shout him down in writing with petitions. It says, what provoked this fury of indignation? Gilley is no simple imperialist. He doesn't deny that inexcusable atrocities occurred under European colonial rule. I mean, neither does Manchester in his book. I mean, if anything, I think he gives a little bit too much weight to those atrocities. They were there. But like Gilley brings out in his paper, what was there before the British showed up? And like we're beginning to see now, what's there after the British leave? It says, it's just that he remembers, this is Nigel Bigger writing at the Times about Gilley and his paper. It's just that he remembers that they also happened before the Europeans arrived and after they left. With Zimbabwe in our minds, we might remember that the massacre of up to 20,000 Netabeli in Zimbabwe in 1983 and 1984 was perpetrated not by the British, but by that patriarch of African nationalism, Robert Mugabe. The notion that colonialism is always and everywhere a bad thing, Gilley writes, needs to be rethought in light of the grave human toll of a century of anti-colonial regimes and policies. Okay, colonialism is bad, you say? Well, what about the alternative? Let's look at that. Let's submit it to peer review. Let's look at the facts. Let's consider the massacres. Let's consider the inexcusable atrocities. Among the virtues of colonial rule, as Gilley sees them, were often the formation of coherent political communities, reliable state institutions, and therefore living spaces where individuals and their families could flourish. He goes on to write, and I only had time to skim through Gilley's paper, but in his paper he quotes from this Nigerian novelist. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but he wrote a book, There Was a Country, and this Nigerian novelist talks about Britain's rule. When Britain governed the colony of Nigeria, how that they did it with considerable care. There was a very highly competent cadre of government officials imbued with a high level of knowledge of how to run a country. This Nigerian author says British colonies were more or less expertly run. That's someone from on the ground in a British colony. A Nigerian, no less, saying that, you know, it was expertly run. You've got to give him credit. He says in his article, again, this is to paraphrase some from Gilley's paper, that one of the most valuable achievements in colonial rule was just law and order. The British institutions of justice. Bigger says here, political order might seem like a very unexciting value, but without it, nothing good can flourish. That's why indigenous people sometimes chose, listen to this, the indigenous people sometimes chose to move into territories governed by colonial regimes rather than away from them. I mean, that's really the acid test, right? If people, even if they're Nigerians or whoever, if they're flocking to come under colonial rule as opposed to leaving in droves, what does that tell you? It says, thus, millions of Chinese took refuge in British Hong Kong. Why would they flee China for Hong Kong in the early years of communist rule in Beijing, why would they leave the communist rule? Why would they want to get out of there? Why would they want to go to Hong Kong? It says, what gave colonial rule popular legitimacy was not democratic elections, but its provision of the goods of security and the rule of law. The rule of law. So when you see this built-in hostility toward colonialism, this automatic, this knee-jerk reaction against it, coming not from Nigerians, but from the educated elites in Portland and elsewhere. Just know that the attack here, really the attack, is on the rule of law. Satan's behind it, of course. And I'm not suggesting that the British Empire was God's empire, but as my father has said, it's as close as you can get in the human level. Imagine what it will be like on this earth when God's empire is set up with God's rule, and there won't be any inexcusable atrocities, just the loving government of God and his family. In any event, there's a lot that we can glean from this history, just this recent history, the last two centuries or so. It says, Gillies' courageous call for a balanced reappraisal of the colonial past is certainly important for the formerly colonized, but it's also important for the former colonizers. For as we British read our past, so we understand ourselves. And as we understand ourselves, so we act in the future. It says, if we believe what strident anti-colonialists tell us, namely, that our imperial past was one long, unbroken litany of oppression, exploitation, and self-deception, then our guilt will make us vulnerable to willful manipulation, and it will confirm us in the belief that the best way we can serve the world is by leaving it alone. And that's what you see happening. It's not just Britain. Now it's the one great superpower in the world, the United States. And so much self-hate that we conclude, well, the best way we can help these other nations, that, by the way, so many of them are going up in flames, all right? But the best way that we can help them is just leave them alone. Just let those regions go up in flames. Just let the civil wars persist. Just let the terrorism and the violence continue. Well, we'll see where that leads. I touched on it the other day. Great tribulation. Look at the alternative to a world dominated by that Anglo-American brotherhood. We see those alliances severing, as I said in the first segment. We see the power of the United States and Britain weakening by the day. Can't even keep the numbers up to what are already low targets in the case of the British military. Well, some interesting thoughts put together by that author there at the Times, commenting on that piece printed by that professor from Portland, Oregon. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with a few emails that have come in over the last few days. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit an email to the show or send in your feedback or comment on any of these programs, you can send your thoughts to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
A few emails from the last few days here. This one says, I greatly enjoyed and benefited from the Bible study series on Saul on your radio program. An educational and sobering topic. Thanks for your zeal in hammering home the truth every day. This comes in response to, I think, the Trumpet brief from Monday. Finally, a proper expose of the facts. After so many years of putting up with feminists excusing President Clinton and saying, what difference does it make? I'm guessing that what's really going on the last few weeks, digging up dirt on every man who ever made a pass at a woman, that perhaps they've been gearing up to go after Trump's comments about women, but are stumbling all over themselves in the meantime. It's pretty tiring. If every man was hauled into court for such alleged contact or conduct, there might end up being trillions of such cases. And of course, all the time obscuring the real urgent news of the day, blinding people to the reality of our times. I noticed, by the way, just the, I guess it was yesterday, I forget if it's Minnesota or one of the northern states there in the Midwest, this woman running for attorney general basically sends out a two-minute commercial saying, vote for me because I'm a woman, and that way you don't have to worry about sexual harassment or sexual misconduct. This is what our state needs. It needs a female governor. It needs a female lieutenant governor. It needs a female attorney general. That's the extreme that we're going to go to now. The problem, as I've said or touched on this past week, the problem, as you'll see, is going to be with men in general. They're going to be the big target that Satan's looking to take down. It doesn't excuse the way these men in power positions are behaving. It's just to tell you what Satan's going to go after and how he's going to use this. Another one here says, thank you so much for the study on Saul. I thought it was quite revealing that, as you said, God was not happy with Saul going 95% of the way and doing most of what he commanded. I feel like this is an important lesson for us today as Christians. We can't be going most of the way for God. We have to go all the way. Thank you for all of your hard work and the whole team over there for supporting this message. Another one here says, I just wanted to say happy Thanksgiving. This came last week, obviously, and let you know how much the 90-second videos help. This is in response to the website, those short videos that we've produced. When I'm working at the public schools, I can refocus. When a 90-second video is available, I have used two of them to show in different classrooms. How about that? The 90-second videos are working their way into the public school system in the United States. Well, hopefully that will continue. We'll see. This one here, I totally enjoyed reading Civilize Your Children. This is in response to a website piece. Having worked in a classroom with behavior adaptation, for 20 years, I've seen a lot of bad behavior. I also witnessed a lot of improved and better behavior in children. After just a few weeks of work, the rule of treating others as you would like to be treated was high on the list. Bad language was not tolerated. It was amazing, amazing and so rewarding to see how nice they could be to each other and to the teachers after just a short while. It's amazing what happens, isn't it? When you actually go to work using God's government, implementing principles of God's law. Another one here says, this is a stunning addition and so welcoming. This is in response to the latest Trumpet. We are living history. Thank you, sir. And yes, this is a day of Thanksgiving. That's in response to Joel Hilliker's brief from last week when he announced the arrival of the new or the latest Trumpet magazine. Another one here says, thank you so much for the monthly magazine. That's from the Philippines. And another one here from Texas says, great title, guys. That's in response again to King Me there on the cover of the latest Trumpet magazine. And then finally, one last one here says, thank you so much for the Trumpet Brief. I am already a subscriber to the Trumpet and a new member of the Philadelphia Church of God in South Africa. Well, welcome to God's church, and thank you for your support of the Trumpet Brief, thetrumpet.com, the radio programs, The Key of David, and on it goes. And it will go on next week on this same station, on this same time, on this same website, if you happen to listen to the podcast, on this same listening device, on this same phone, if that's the way you listen. You're listening to Stephen Fleury. This is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you next week.